and stepping onto the sun deck a few weeks later with both of his parents to see, thin blades of grass emerge from the bald black lawn. In the beginning, in the evenings, his family goes for drives, exploring their new environs bit by bit. The neglected dirt lanes, the shaded back roads, the farms where one could pick pumpkins in autumn and buy berries sold in green cardboard boxes in July. The back seat of the car is sheathed with plastic, the ashtrays on the doors still sealed. They drive until it grows dark, without destination in mind, past hidden ponds and graveyards, cul-de-sac, and dead ends. Sometimes they drive out of town altogether, to one of the beaches along the North Shore. Even in summer, they never go to swim or to turn brown beneath the sun. Instead, they go dressed in their ordinary clothes. By the time they arrive, the ticket collector's booth is empty, the crowd's gone. There are only a handful of cars in the parking lot, and the only other visitors are people walking their dogs or watching the sunset or dragging metal detectors through the sand. Together, as the Gangulis drive, they anticipate the moment the thin blue line of ocean will come into view. On the beach, Goggle collects rocks, digs tunnels in the sand. He and his father wander barefoot, their pant legs rolled halfway up their calves. He watches his father raise a kite within minutes into the wind, so high that Goggle must tip his head back in order to see a rippling speck against the sky. The wind whips around their ears, turning their faces cold. Snowy gulls hover with wings spread low enough to touch. Goggle darts in and out of the ocean, making faint, temporary footprints, soaking his rolled-up cuffs. His mother cries out, laughing, as she lifts up her sari a few inches above her ankles, her slippers in one hand, and places her feet in foaming, ice-cold water. She reaches out to Goggle, takes his hand. "Not so far," she tells him. The waves retract, gathering force, the soft, dark sand seeming to shift away instantly beneath their feet, causing them to lose their balance. "I'm falling! It's pulling me in," she always says. The August that Goggle turns 5, Ashima discovers she is pregnant again. In the mornings, she forces herself to eat a slice of toast, only because Ashok makes it for her and watches her while she chews it in bed. Her head constantly spins. She spends her days lying down, a pink plastic waste paper basket by her side, the shades drawn, her mouth and teeth coated with the taste of metal. She watches The Price is Right and Guiding Light and the $10,000 pyramid on the television as Ashok moves in from the living room to her side of the bed. Staggering out to the kitchen at lunchtime to prepare a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for Goggle, she is revolted by the odor of the fridge, convinced that the contents of her vegetable drawers have been replaced with garbage, that meat is rotting on the shelves. Sometimes Goggle lies beside her in his parents' bedroom, reading a picture book or coloring with crayons. "You're going to be an older brother," she tells him one day. "There'll be someone to call you Dada. Won't that be exciting?" Sometimes, if she's feeling energetic, she asks Goggle to go and get a photo album, and together they look at pictures of Goggle's grandparents and his uncles and aunts and cousins, of whom, in spite of his one visit to Calcutta, he has no memory. She teaches him to memorize a 4-line children's poem by Tagore and the names of the deities adorning the 10-handed goddess Durga during Puja. Sharashati with her swan and Kartik with his peacock to her left, Lakshmi with her owl, and Ganesh with his mouse to her right. Every afternoon, Ashima sleeps, but before nodding off, she switches the television to Channel 2 and tells Goggle to watch Sesame Street and The Electric Company in order to keep up with the English he uses at nursery school. In the evenings, Goggle and his father eat together, alone, a week's worth of chicken curry and rice, which his father cooks in 2 battered Dutch ovens every Sunday. As the food reheats, his father tells Goggle to shut the bedroom door because his mother cannot tolerate the smell. It is odd to see his father presiding in the kitchen, standing in his mother's place at the stove. When they sit down at the table, the sound of his parents' conversation is missing, as is the sound of the television in the living room playing the news. His father eats with his head bent over his plate, flipping through the latest issue of Time, occasionally glancing at Goggle to make sure he is eating as well. Though his father remembers to mix up the rice and curry for Goggle beforehand, he doesn't bother to shape it into individual balls the way his mother does, lining them around his plate like the numbers on a clock face. Goggle has already been taught to eat on his own with his fingers, not to let the food stain the skin of his palm. He has learned to suck the marrow from lamb, to extract the bones from fish. But without his mother at the table, he does not feel like eating. He keeps wishing every evening that she would emerge from the bedroom and sit between him and his father, filling the air with her sari and cardigan smell. He grows bored of eating the same thing day after day, and one evening he discreetly pushes the remaining food to the side. With his index finger in the traces of leftover sauce, he begins to draw on his plate. He plays tic-tac-toe. "Finish," his father says, glancing up from his magazine. "Don't play with food that way."
"I'm full, Baba."
"There's still some food on your plate."
"Baba, I can't."
His father's plate is polished clean, the chicken bones denuded of cartilage and chewed to a pinkish pulp, the bay leaf and cinnamon stick as good as new. Ashok shakes his head at Goggle, disapproving, unyielding. Each day, Ashok is pained by the half-eaten sandwiches people toss into garbage cans on campus, apples abandoned after one or two bites.
"Finish it, Goggle."
"At your age, I ate tin."
Because his mother tends to vomit the moment she finds herself in a moving car, she is unable to accompany her husband to take Goggle in September of 1973 to his first day of kindergarten at the town's public elementary school. By the time Goggle starts, it is already the second week of the school year. But for the past week, Goggle has been in bed, just like his mother, listless, without appetite, claiming to have a stomachache, even vomiting one day into his mother's pink waste paper basket. He doesn't want to go to kindergarten. He doesn't want to wear the new clothes his mother has bought him from Sears, hanging on the knob of his dresser, or carry his Charlie Brown lunchbox, or board the yellow school bus that stops at the end of Pemberton Road. The school, unlike the nursery school, is several miles from the house, several miles from the university. On numerous occasions he's been driven to see the building, a low, long brick structure with a perfectly flat roof and a flag that flaps at the top of a tall white pole planted on the lawn. There is a reason Goggle doesn't want to go to kindergarten. His parents have told him that at school, instead of being called Goggle, he'll be called by a new name, a good name, which his parents have finally decided on, just in time for him to begin his formal education. The name, Nikhil, is artfully connected to the old. Not only is it a perfectly respectable Bengali good name, meaning he who is entire, encompassing all, but it also bears a satisfying resemblance to Nikolai, the first name of the Russian Goggle. Ashok had thought of it recently, staring mindlessly at the Goggle spines in the library, and he had rushed back to the house to ask Ashima her opinion. He pointed out that it was relatively easy to pronounce, though there was the danger that Americans, obsessed with abbreviation, would truncate it to Nick. She told him she liked it well enough, though later, alone, she'd wept, thinking of her grandmother, who had died earlier in the year, and of the letter forever hovering somewhere between India and America, containing the good name she'd chosen for Goggle. Ashima still dreams of the letter at times, discovering it after all these years in the mailbox on Pemberton Road, opening it only to find it blank. But Goggle doesn't want a new name. He can't understand why he has to answer to anything else. "Why do I have to have a new name?" he asks his parents, tears springing to his eyes. It would be one thing if his parents were to call him Nikhil too, but they tell him that the new name will only be used by the teachers and children at school. He is afraid to be Nikhil, someone he doesn't know, who doesn't know him. His parents tell him that they each have two names too, as do all their Bengali friends in America and all their relatives in Calcutta. "It's a part of growing up," they tell him, "part of being a Bengali." They write it for him on a sheet of paper, ask him to copy it over 10 times. "Don't worry," his father says. "To me and your mother, you will never be anyone but Gogol." At school, Ashok and Gogol are greeted by the secretary, Mrs. McNab, who asks Ashok to fill out a registration form. He provides a copy of Gogol's birth certificate and immunization record, which Mrs. McNab puts in a folder along with the registration. "This way," Mrs. McNab says, leading them to the principal's office. "Candice Lapidus," the name on the door says. Mrs. Lapidus assures Ashok that missing the first week of kindergarten is not a problem, that things have yet to settle down. Mrs. Lapidus is a tall, slender woman with short, white blonde hair. She wears frosted blue eyeshadow and a lemon-yellow suit. She shakes Ashok's hand and tells him that there are 2 other Indian children at the school, Jayadev Modi in the 3rd grade and Rekha Zaxina in 5th. Perhaps the Gangulis know them. Ashok tells Mrs. Lapidus that they do not. She looks at the registration form and smiles kindly at the boy who is clutching his father's hand. Gogol is dressed in powder blue pants, red and white canvas sneakers, a striped turtleneck top. "Welcome to elementary school, Nikhil. I am your principal, Mrs. Lapidus." Gogol looks down at his sneakers. The way the principal pronounces his new name is different from the way his parents say it. The second part of it longer, sounding like heel. She bends down so that her face is level with his and extends a hand to his shoulder. "Can you tell me how old you are, Nikhil?" When the question is repeated and there is still no response, Mrs. Lapidus asks, "Mr. Ganguly, does Nikhil follow English?" "Of course he follows," Ashok says. "My son is perfectly bilingual." In order to prove that Gogol knows English, Ashok does something he has never done before and addresses his son in careful, accented English. "Go on, Gogol," he says, patting him on the head. "Tell Mrs. Lapidus how old you are." "What was that?" Mrs. Lapidus says.
"I beg your pardon, madam?"
"That name you called him. Something with a G?"
"Oh, that is what we call him at home only. But his good name should be, is," he nods his head firmly, "Nikhil."
Mrs. Lapidus frowns.
"I'm afraid I don't understand. Good name?"
"Yes." Mrs. Lapidus studies the registration form. She has not had to go through this confusion with the other 2 Indian children. She opens up the folder and examines the immunization record, the birth certificate.
"There seems to be some confusion, Mr. Ganguly," she says. "According to these documents, your son's legal name is Gogol."
"That is correct, but please allow me to explain."
"That you want us to call him Nikhil?"
"That is correct." Mrs. Lapidus nods. "The reason being?"
"That is our wish."
"I'm not sure I follow you, Mr. Ganguly. Do you mean that Nikhil is a middle name or a nickname?"
"Many of the children go by nicknames here. On this form, there is a space."
No, it's not a middle name," Ashok says. He's beginning to lose patience. "He has no middle name, no nickname. The boy's good name, his school name, is Nikhil."
Mrs. Lapidus presses her lips together and smiles. But clearly he doesn't respond.
"Please, Mrs. Lapidus," Ashok says. "It is very common for a child to be confused at first. Please give it some time. I assure you, he will grow accustomed."
He bends down and this time in Bengali, calmly and quietly, asks Gogol to please answer when Mrs. Lapidus asks a question.
"Don't be scared, Gogol," he says, raising his son's chin with his finger. "You're a big boy now. No tears."
Though Mrs. Lapidus doesn't understand a word, she listens carefully, hears that name again, Gogol. Lightly, in pencil, she writes it down on the registration form. Ashok hands over the lunchbox, a windbreaker in case it gets cold. He thanks Mrs. Lapidus.
"Be good, Nikhil," he says in English, and then, after a moment's hesitation, he is gone.
When they are alone, Mrs. Lapidus asks. Are you happy to be entering elementary school, Goggle?
My parents want me to have another name in school.
And what about you, Goggle? Do you want to be called by another name? After a pause, he shakes his head. Is that a no? He nods. Yes. Then it's settled. Can you write your name on this piece of paper?
Goggle picks up a pencil, grips it tightly, and forms the letters of the only word he has learned thus far to write from memory, getting the L backward due to nerves.
What beautiful penmanship you have, Mrs. Lapidus says. She tears up the old registration form and asks Mrs. McNabb to type up a new one. Then she takes Goggle by the hand down a carpeted hallway with painted cement walls. She opens the door and Goggle is introduced to his teacher, Miss Watkins, a woman with hair in two braids, wearing overalls and clogs. Inside the classroom, it's a small universe of nicknames. Andrew is Andy, Alexandra, Sandy, William, Billy, Elizabeth, Lizzie. It is nothing like the schooling Goggle's parents have known. Fountain pens and polished black shoes and notebooks and good names and sir or madam at a tender age. Here, the only official ritual is pledging allegiance first thing in the morning to the American flag. For the rest of the day, they sit at a communal round table, drinking punch and eating cookies, taking naps on little orange cushions on the floor. At the end of his first day, he is sent home with a letter to his parents from Mrs. Lapidus, folded and stapled to a string around his neck, explaining that due to their son's preference, he will be known as Goggle at school.
What about the parents' preference? Ashima and Ashok wonder, shaking their heads.
But since neither of them feels comfortable pressing the issue, they have no choice but to give in. And so, Goggle's formal education begins. At the top of sheets of scratchy pale yellow paper, he writes out his pet name again and again, and the alphabet in capitals and lowercase. He learns to add and subtract, and to spell his first words. In the front cover of the textbooks from which he is taught to read, he leaves his legacy, writing his name in number 2 pencil below a series of others. In art class, his favorite hour of the week, he carves his name with paper clips into the bottom of clay cups and bowls. He pastes uncooked pasta to cardboard and leaves his signature in fat brush strokes below paintings. Day after day, he brings his creations home to Ashima, who hangs them proudly on the refrigerator door. Goggle G, he signs his work in the lower right-hand corner, as if there were a need to distinguish him from any other Goggle in the school. In May, his sister is born. This time, the labor happens quickly. They are thinking about going to a yard sale in the neighborhood one Saturday morning, playing Bengali songs on the stereo. Goggle is eating frozen waffles for breakfast, wishing his parents would turn off the music so that he could hear the cartoons he is watching, when his mother's water breaks. His father switches off the music and calls Dilip and Maya Nandi, who now live in a suburb 20 minutes away and have a little boy of their own. Then he calls the next-door neighbor, Mrs. Merton, who has offered to look after Goggle until the Nandis arrive. Though his parents have prepared him for the event, when Mrs. Merton shows up with her needlepoint, he feels stranded, no longer in the mood for cartoons. He stands on the front step, watching his father help his mother into the car, waving as they pull away. To pass time, he draws a picture of himself and his parents and his new sibling, standing in a row in front of their house. He remembers to put a dot on his mother's forehead, glasses on his father's face, a lamppost by the flagstone path in front of the house.
Well, if that's not the spitting image, Mrs. Merton says, looking over his shoulder.
That evening, Maya Nandi, whom he calls Maya Mashi, as if she were his own mother's sister, his own aunt, is heating up the dinner she's brought over, when his father calls to say the baby has arrived. The next day, Goggle sees his mother sitting in an angled bed, a plastic bracelet around her wrist, her stomach no longer as hard and round. Through a big glass window, he sees his sister asleep, lying in a small glass bed, the only one of the babies in the nursery to have a thick head of black hair. He is introduced to his mother's nurses. He drinks the juice and eats the pudding off his mother's tray. Shyly, he gives his mother the picture he's drawn. Underneath the figures, he's written his own name and Ma and Baba. Only the space under the baby is blank. "I didn't know the baby's name," Goggle says, which is when his parents tell him. This time, Ashok and Ashima are ready. They have the names lined up for a boy or a girl. They've learned their lesson after Goggle. They've learned that schools in America will ignore parents' instructions and register a child under his pet name. The only way to avoid such confusion, they have concluded, is to do away with the pet name altogether, as many of their Bengali friends have already done. For their daughter, good name and pet name are one and the same. Sonali, meaning she who is golden. 2 days later, coming back from school, Goggle finds his mother at home again, wearing a bathrobe instead of a sari, and sees his sister awake for the first time. She is dressed in pink pajamas that conceal her hands and feet, with a pink bonnet tied around her moon-shaped face. His father is home, too. His parents sit Goggle on the living room sofa and place Sonali in his lap, telling him to hold her against his chest, a hand cupped under her head, and his father takes pictures with a new Nikon 35mm camera. The shutter advances softly, repeatedly. The room is bathed in rich afternoon light. "Hi, Sonali," Goggle says, sitting stiffly, looking down at her face and then up at the lens. Though Sonali is the name on her birth certificate, the name she will carry officially through life, at home they begin to call her Sonu, then Sona, and finally Sonia. Sonia makes her a citizen of the world. It's a Russian link to her brother. It's European, South American. Eventually, it will be the name of the Indian Prime Minister's Italian wife. At first, Goggle is disappointed by the fact he can't play with her, that all she does is sleep and soil her diapers and cry. But eventually, she begins to respond to him, cackling when he tickles her stomach, or pushes her in a swing operated by a noisy crank, or when he cries out, "Peekaboo!" He helps his mother to bathe her, fetching the towel and the shampoo. He entertains her in the back seat of the car when they drive on the highway on Saturday evenings, on the way to dinner parties thrown by their parents' friends. For by now, all the Cambridge Bengalis have moved to places like Dedham and Framingham and Lexington and Winchester, to houses with backyards and driveways. They have met so many Bengalis that there is rarely a Saturday free. So that for the rest of his life, Goggle's childhood memories of Saturday evenings will consist of a single repeated scene. 30-odd people in a 3-bedroom suburban house, the children watching television or playing board games in a basement, the parents eating and conversing in the Bengali their children don't speak among themselves. He will remember eating watered-down curry off paper plates, sometimes pizza or Chinese ordered specially for the kids. There are so many guests invited to Sonia's rice ceremony that Ashok arranges to rent a building on campus, with 20 folding tables and an industrial stove. Unlike her compliant older brother, Sonia, 7 months old, refuses all the food. She plays with the dirt they've dug up from the yard and threatens to put the dollar bill into her mouth. "This one," one of the guests remarks, "this one is the true American." As their lives in New England swell with fellow Bengali friends, the members of that other former life, those who know Ashima and Ashok, not by their good names but as Monu and Mitu, slowly dwindle. More deaths come, more telephone calls startle them in the middle of the night, more letters arrive in the mailbox informing them of aunts and uncles no longer with them. The news of these deaths never gets lost in the mail as other letters do. Somehow, bad news, however ridden with static, however filled with echoes, always manages to be conveyed. Within a decade abroad, they are both orphaned. Ashok's parents both dead from cancer, Ashima's mother from kidney disease. Goggle and Sonia are woken by these deaths in the early mornings, their parents screaming on the other side of thin bedroom walls. They stumble into their parents' room, uncomprehending, embarrassed at the sight of their parents' tears, feeling only slightly sad. In some senses, Ashok and Ashima lived the lives of the extremely aged, those for whom everyone they once knew and loved is lost, those who survive and are consoled by memory alone. Even those family members who continue to live seem dead somehow, always invisible, impossible to touch. Voices on the phone, occasionally bearing news of births and weddings, send chills down their spines. How could it be still alive, still talking? The sight of them when they visit Calcutta every few years feels stranger still, 6 or 8 weeks passing like a dream. Once back on Pemberton Road, in the modest house that is suddenly mammoth, there is nothing to remind them, in spite of the 100 or so relatives they've just seen. They feel as if they are the only Gangulis in the world. The people they have grown up with will never see this life. Of this, they are certain. They will never breathe the air of a damp New England morning, see smoke rising from a neighbor's chimney, shiver in a car waiting for the glass to defrost and the engine to warm. And yet, to a casual observer, the Gangulis, apart from the name on their mailbox, apart from the issues of India Broad and Sangbad Bichitra that are delivered there, appear no different from their neighbors. Their garage, like every other, contains shovels and pruning shears and a sled. They purchase a barbecue for tandoori on the porch in summer. Each step, each acquisition, no matter how small, involves deliberation, consultation with Bengali friends. Was there a difference between a plastic rake and a metal one? Which was preferable, a live Christmas tree or an artificial one? They learn to roast turkeys, albeit rubbed with garlic and cumin and cayenne, at Thanksgiving, to nail a wreath to their door in December, to wrap woolen scarves around snowmen, to color boiled eggs violet and pink at Easter and hide them around the house. For the sake of Gogol and Sonia, they celebrate, with progressively increasing fanfare, the birth of Christ, an event the children look forward to far more than the worship of Durga and Sharashati. During pujos, scheduled for convenience on 2 Saturdays a year, Gogol and Sonia are dragged off to a high school or a Knights of Columbus hall, overtaken by Bengalis, where they are required to throw marigold petals at a cardboard effigy of a goddess and eat bland vegetarian food. It can't compare to Christmas, when they hang stockings on the fireplace mantel and set out cookies and milk for Santa Claus and receive heaps of presents and stay home from school. There are other ways in which Ashok and Ashima give in. Though Ashima continues to wear nothing but saris and sandals from Bata, Ashok, accustomed to wearing tailor-made pants and shirts all his life, learns to buy ready-made. He trades in fountain pens for ballpoints, Wilkinson blades and his boar-bristled shaving brush for Bic razors bought 6 to a pack. Though he is now a tenured full professor, he stops wearing jackets and ties to the university, given that there is a clock everywhere he turns, at the side of his bed, over the stove where he prepares tea, in the car he drives to work, on the wall opposite his desk. He stops wearing a wristwatch, resigning his favor luba to the depths of his sock drawer. In the supermarket, they let Gogol fill the cart with items that he and Sonia, but not they, consume. Individually wrapped slices of cheese, mayonnaise, tuna fish, hot dogs. For Gogol's lunches, they stand at the deli to buy cold cuts, and in the mornings, Ashima makes sandwiches with bologna or roast beef. At his insistence, she concedes and makes him an American dinner once a week as a treat, shake-and-bake chicken or hamburger helper prepared with ground lamb. Still, they do what they can. They make a point of driving into Cambridge with the children when the Apu trilogy plays at the Orson Welles, or when there is a Kathakali dance performance or a sitar recital at Memorial Hall. When Gogol is in the 3rd grade, they send him to Bengali language and culture lessons every other Saturday, held in the home of one of their friends. For when Ashima and Ashok close their eyes, it never fails to unsettle them that their children sound just like Americans, expertly conversing in a language that still at times confounds them, in accents they are accustomed not to trust. In Bengali class, Gogol is taught to read and write his ancestral alphabet, which begins at the back of his throat with an unaspirated K and marches steadily across the roof of his mouth ending with elusive vowels that hover outside his lips. He is taught to write letters that hang from a bar, and eventually to cobble these intricate shapes into his name. They read handouts written in English about the Bengali Renaissance and the revolutionary exploits of Subhas Chandra Bose. The children in the class study without interest, wishing they could be at ballet or softball practice instead. Gogol hates it because it keeps him from attending every other session of a Saturday morning drawing class he's enrolled in, at the suggestion of his art teacher. The drawing class is held on the top floor of the public library. On nice days, they are taken for walks through the historic district, carrying large sketch pads and pencils, and told to draw the facade of this building or that. In Bengali class, they read from hand-sewn primers brought back by their teacher from Calcutta, intended for five-year-olds, printed, Gogol can't help noticing, on paper that resembles the folded toilet paper he uses at school. As a young boy, Gogol doesn't mind his name. He recognizes pieces of himself in road signs. Go left, go right, go slow. For birthdays, his mother orders a cake on which his name is piped across the white frosted surface in a bright blue sugary script. It all seems perfectly normal. It doesn't bother him that his name is never an option on keychains or metal pins or refrigerator magnets. He has been told that he was named after a famous Russian author born in a previous century, that the author's name, and therefore his, is known throughout the world and will live on forever. One day his father takes him to the university library and shows him on a shelf well beyond his reach a row of Gogol spines. When his father opens up one of the books to a random page, the print is far smaller than in the Hardy Boy series Gogol has begun recently to enjoy. In a few years, his father tells him, you'll be ready to read them. Those substitute teachers at school always pause, looking apologetic when they arrive at his name on the roster, forcing Gogol to call out, before even being summoned, "That's me!" Teachers in the school system know not to give it a second thought. After a year or two, the students no longer tease and say giggle or gargle. In the programs of the school Christmas plays, the parents are accustomed to seeing his name among the cast. Gogol is an outstanding student, curious and cooperative, his teachers write year after year on report cards. Go, Gogol! His classmates shout on golden autumn days as he runs the bases or sprints in a dash. As for his last name, Ganguly, by the time he is 10, he has been to Calcutta 3 more times, twice in summer and once during Durga Puja, and from the most recent trip, he still remembers the sight of it etched respectably into the whitewashed exterior of his paternal grandparents' house. He remembers the astonishment of seeing 6 pages full of Gangulis, 3 columns to a page in the Calcutta telephone directory. He'd wanted to rip out the page as a souvenir, but when he had told this to one of his cousins, the cousin had laughed. On taxi rides through the city, going to visit the various homes of his relatives, his father had pointed out the name elsewhere, on the awnings of confectioners and stationers and opticians. He had told Gogol that Ganguly is a legacy of the British, an anglicized way of pronouncing his real surname, Gangopatei. Back home on Pemberton Road, he helps his father paste individual golden letters bought from a rack in the hardware store, spelling out Ganguly on one side of their mailbox. One morning, the day after Halloween, Gogol discovers on his way back to the bus stop that it has been shortened to Gang, with the word green scrawled in pencil following it. His ears burn at the sight, and he runs back into the house sickened, certain of the insult his father will feel. Though it is his last name, too, something tells Gogol that the desecration is intended for his parents more than Sonia and him. For by now he is aware, in stores, of cashiers smirking at his parents' accents, and of salesmen who prefer to direct their conversation to Gogol, as though his parents were either incompetent or deaf. But his father is unaffected at such moments, just as he is unaffected by the mailbox. It's only boys having fun, he tells Gogol, flicking the matter away with the back of a hand. And that evening they drive back to the hardware store to buy the missing letters again. Then one day, the peculiarity of his name becomes apparent. He is 11 years old in the 6th grade, on a school field trip of some historical intent. They set off in their school bus, two classes, two teachers, two chaperones along for the ride, driving straight through the town and onto the highway. It is a chilly, spectacular November day. The blue sky cloudless, the trees shedding bright yellow leaves that blanket the ground. The children scream and sing and drink cans of soda wrapped in aluminum foil. First they visit a textile mill somewhere in Rhode Island. The next stop is a small unpainted wooden house with tiny windows sitting on a large plot of land. Inside, after adjusting to the diminished light, they stare at a desk with an inkwell at its top, a soot-stained fireplace, a washtub, a short, narrow bed. It was once the home of a poet, they are told. All the furniture is roped off from the center of the room, with little signs telling them not to touch. The ceiling is so low that the teachers duck their heads as they walk from darkened room to room. They look at the kitchen with its iron stove and stone sink and file along a dirt path to look at the outhouse. The students shriek with disgust at the sight of a tin pan hanging from the bottom of a wooden chair. In the gift shop, Goggle buys a postcard of the house and a ballpoint pen disguised as a quill. The final stop on the field trip, a short distance by bus from the poet's house, is a graveyard where the writer lies buried. They take a few minutes wandering from stone to stone, among thick and thin tablets, some leaning back as if pressed by a wind. The stones are square and arched, black and gray, more often plain than shiny, caked with lichen and moss. On many of the stones, the inscriptions have faded. They find a stone that bears the poet's name. "Line up," the teachers say. "It's time for a project." The students are each given several sheets of newsprint and thick-colored crayons whose labels have been peeled. Goggle can't help but feel a chill. He's never set foot in a graveyard before, only glimpsed them in passing, riding in cars. There's a large one on the outskirts of their town. Once, stuck in traffic, he and his family had witnessed a burial from a distance, and ever since then, whenever they drive by, his mother always tells them to avert their eyes. To Goggle's surprise, they are told not to draw the gravestones, but to rub their surfaces. A teacher crouches down, one hand holding the newsprint in place, and shows them how. The children begin to scamper between rows of the dead, over leathery leaves, looking for their own names. A handful triumphant when they are able to claim a grave they are related to. "Smith," they holler. "Collins! Wood!" Goggle is old enough to know that there is no Ganguly here. He is old enough to know that he himself will be burned, not buried, that his body will occupy no plot of earth, that no stone in this country will bear his name beyond life. In Calcutta, from taxis and once from the roof of his grandparents' house, he has seen the dead bodies of strangers carried on people's shoulders through streets, decked with flowers, wrapped in sheets. He walks over to a slim, blackened stone with a pleasing shape, rounded at the top before rising into a cross. He kneels on the grass and holds up the newsprint, then begins to rub gently with the side of his crayon. The sun is already sinking, and his fingers are stiff with cold. The teachers and chaperones sit on the ground, legs extended, leaning back against the headstones, the aroma of their menthol cigarettes drifting through the air. At first, nothing appears apart from a grainy, featureless wash of midnight blue. But then, suddenly, the crayon meets with slight resistance, and letters, one after another, emerge magically on the page. Abijah Craven. 1701 to 1745. Goggle has never met a person named Abijah, just as, he now realizes, he has never met another Goggle. He wonders how to pronounce Abijah, whether it's a man's or a woman's name. He walks to another tombstone, less than a foot tall, and presses another sheet of paper to its surface. This one says, "Anguish Mather, a child." He shudders, imagining bones no larger than his, below the ground. Some of the other children in the class, already bored with the project, begin chasing one another around the stones, pushing and teasing and snapping gum. But Goggle goes from grave to grave with paper and crayon in hand, bringing to life one name after another. Peregrine Wotton, died 1699. Ezekiel and Uriah Lockwood, brothers. R.I.P. He likes these names. Likes their oddness, their flamboyance. Now, those are some names you don't see very often these days, one of the chaperones passing by and looking down at his rubbings remarks. Sort of like yours. Until now, it has not occurred to Goggle that names die over time, that they perish just as people do. On the ride back to school, the rubbings made by other children are torn up, crumpled, tossed at one another's heads, abandoned below the dark green seats. But Goggle is silent, his rubbings rolled up carefully like parchment in his lap. At home, his mother is horrified. What type of field trip was this? It was enough that they applied lipstick to their corpses and buried them in silk-lined boxes. Only in America, a phrase she has begun to resort to often these days, only in America are children taken to cemeteries in the name of art. What's next? She demands to know. A trip to the morgue? In Calcutta, the burning ghats are the most forbidden of places, she tells Goggle. And though she tries her best not to, though she was here, not there, both times it happened, she sees her parents' bodies swallowed by flames. Death is not a pastime, she says, her voice rising unsteadily. Not a place to make paintings. She refuses to display the rubbings in the kitchen alongside his other creations, his charcoal drawings and his magazine collages, his pencil sketch of a Greek temple copied from an encyclopedia, his pastel image of the public library's facade, awarded first place in a contest sponsored by the library trustees. Never before has she rejected a piece of her son's art. The guilt she feels at Goggle's deflated expression is leavened by common sense. How can she be expected to cook dinner for her family with the names of dead people on the walls? But Goggle is attached to them. For reasons he cannot explain or necessarily understand, these ancient Puritan spirits, these very first immigrants to America, these bearers of unthinkable, obsolete names have spoken to him, so much so that in spite of his mother's disgust, he refuses to throw the rubbings away. He rolls them up, takes them upstairs, and puts them in his room, behind his chest of drawers, where he knows his mother will never bother to look, and where they will remain ignored but protected, gathering dust for years to come. Chapter 4, 1982. Goggle's 14th birthday. Like most events in his life, it is another excuse for his parents to throw a party for their Bengali friends. His own friends from school were invited the previous day, a tame affair, with pizzas that his father picked up on his way home from work, a basketball game watched together on television, some ping pong in the den. For the first time in his life, he has said no to the frosted cake, the box of Harlequin ice cream, the hot dogs in buns, the balloons and streamers taped to the walls. The other celebration, the Bengali one, is held on the closest Saturday to the actual date of his birth. As usual, his mother cooks for days beforehand, cramming the refrigerator with stacks of foil-covered trays. She makes sure to prepare his favorite things. Lamb curry with lots of potatoes, luchis, thick chana dal with swollen brown raisins, pineapple chutney, sandwiches molded out of saffron-tinted ricotta cheese. All this is less stressful to her than the task of feeding a handful of American children, half of whom always claim they are allergic to milk, all of whom refuse to eat the crusts of their bread. Close to 40 guests come from 3 different states. Women are dressed in saris far more dazzling than the pants and polo shirts their husbands wear. A group of men sit in a circle on the floor and immediately start a game of poker. These are his mashis and meshos, his honorary aunts and uncles. They all bring their children. His parents' crowd does not believe in babysitters. As usual, Goggle is the oldest child in the group. He is too old to be playing hide-and-seek with 8-year-old Sonia and her ponytailed gap-toothed friends, but not old enough to sit in the living room and discuss Reaganomics with his father and the rest of the husbands, or to sit around the dining room table gossiping with his mother and the wives. The closest person to him in age is a girl named Moshumi, whose family recently moved to Massachusetts from England, and whose 13th birthday was celebrated in a similar fashion a few months ago. but Goggle and Moshumi have nothing to say to each other. Moshumi sits cross-legged on the floor, in glasses with maroon plastic frames and a puffy polka-dotted headband, holding back her thick, chin-length hair. In her lap is a Kelly Green Bermuda bag with pink piping and wooden handles. Inside the bag is a tube of 7-Up flavored lip balm that she draws from time to time across her mouth. She is reading a well-thumbed paperback copy of Pride and Prejudice, while the other children, Goggle included, watch The Love Boat and Fantasy Island, piled together on top and around the sides of his parents' bed. Occasionally, one of the children asks Moshumi to say something, anything, in her English accent. Sonia asks if she's ever seen Princess Diana on the street. "I detest American television," Moshumi eventually declares to everyone's delight, then wanders into the hallway to continue her reading. Presents are opened when the guests are gone. Goggle receives several dictionaries, several calculators, several cross pen and pencil sets, several ugly sweaters. His parents give him an Instamatic camera, a new sketchbook, colored pencils, and the mechanical pen he'd asked for, and $20 to spend as he wishes. Sonia has made him a card with magic markers, on paper she's ripped out of one of his own sketchbooks, which says, "Happy birthday, Goggles," the name she insists on calling him instead of Dada. His mother sets aside the things he doesn't like, which is most everything, to give to his cousins next time they go to India. Later that night, he's alone in his room, listening to side 3 of the White Album on his parents' cast-off RCA turntable. The album is a present from his American birthday party, given to him by one of his friends at school. Born when the band was near death, Goggle is a passionate devotee of John, Paul, George, and Ringo. In recent years, he has collected nearly all their albums, and the only thing tacked to the bulletin board on the back of his door is Lennon's obituary, already yellow and brittle, clipped from the Boston Globe. He sits cross-legged on the bed, hunched over the lyrics, when he hears a knock on the door. "Come in," he hollers, expecting it to be Sonia in her pajamas, asking if she can borrow his magic eight ball or his Rubik's Cube. He is surprised to see his father, standing in stocking feet, a small pot belly visible beneath his oat-colored sweater vest, his mustache turning gray. Goggle is especially surprised to see a gift in his father's hands. His father has never given him birthday presents apart from whatever his mother buys. But this year, his father says, walking across the room to where Goggle is sitting, he has something special. The gift is covered in red and green and gold striped paper left over from Christmas the year before, taped awkwardly at the seams. It is obviously a book, thick, hardcover, wrapped by his father's own hands. Goggle lifts the paper slowly, but in spite of this, the tape leaves a scab. "The Short Stories of Nikolai Gogol," the jacket says. Inside, the price has been snipped away on the diagonal. "I ordered it from the bookstore just for you," his father says, his voice raised in order to be heard over the music. "It's difficult to find in hardcover these days. It's a British publication, a very small press. It took 4 months to arrive. I hope you like it." Goggle leans over toward the stereo to turn the volume down a bit. He would have preferred The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or even another copy of The Hobbit, to replace the one he lost last summer in Calcutta, left on the rooftop of his father's house in Alipur, and snatched away by crows. In spite of his father's occasional suggestions, he has never been inspired to read a word of Goggle, or any Russian writer for that matter. He has never been told why he was really named Goggle. Doesn't know about the accident that nearly killed his father. He thinks his father's limp is the consequence of an injury playing soccer in his teens. He's been told only half the truth about Goggle, that his father is a fan. "Thanks, Baba," Goggle says, eager to return to his lyrics. Lately he's been lazy, addressing his parents in English, though they continue to speak to him in Bengali. Occasionally he wanders through the house with his running sneakers on. At dinner, he sometimes uses a fork. His father is still standing there in his room, watching expectantly, his hands clasped together behind his back, so Goggle flips through the book. A single picture at the front, on smoother paper than the rest of the pages, shows a pencil drawing of the author, sporting a velvet jacket, a billowy white shirt, and cravat. The face is fox-like, with small dark eyes, a thin, neat mustache, and extremely large, pointy nose. Dark hair slants steeply across his forehead and is plastered to either side of his head. And there is a disturbing, vaguely supercilious smile set into long, narrow lips. Goggle Ganguly is relieved to see no resemblance. True, his nose is long, but not so long. His hair dark, but surely not so dark. His skin pale, but certainly not so pale. The style of his own hair is altogether different, thick, beetle-like bangs that conceal his brows. Goggle Ganguly wears a Harvard sweatshirt and gray Levi's corduroys. He has worn a tie once in his life to attend a friend's bar mitzvah. No, he concludes confidently. There is no resemblance at all. For by now, he's come to hate questions pertaining to his name, hates having constantly to explain. He hates having to tell people that it doesn't mean anything in Indian. He hates having to wear a name tag on his sweater at Model United Nations Day at school. He even hates signing his name at the bottom of his drawings in art class. He hates that his name is both absurd and obscure, that it has nothing to do with who he is, that it is neither Indian nor American, but of all things, Russian. He hates having to live with it, with a pet name turned good name. Day after day, second after second, he hates seeing it on the brown paper sleeve of the National Geographic subscription his parents got him for his birthday the year before, and perpetually listed in the honor roll printed in the town's newspaper. At times, his name, an entity shapeless and weightless, manages, nevertheless, to distress him physically, like the scratchy tag of a shirt he has been forced permanently to wear. At times he wishes he could disguise it, shorten it somehow, the way the other Indian boy in his school, Jayadev, had gotten people to call him Jay. But Goggle, already short and catchy, resists mutation. Other boys his age have begun to court girls already, asking them to go to the movies or the pizza parlor, but he cannot imagine saying, "Hi, it's Goggle," under potentially romantic circumstances. He cannot imagine this at all. From the little he knows about Russian writers, it dismays him that his parents chose the weirdest namesake. Leo or Anton, he could have lived with. Alexander, shortened to Alex, he would have greatly preferred. But Goggle sounds ludicrous to his ears, lacking dignity or gravity. What dismays him most is the irrelevance of it all. Goggle, he's been tempted to tell his father on more than one occasion, was his father's favorite author, not his. Then again, it's his own fault. He could have been known, at school at least, as Nikhil. That one day, that first day of kindergarten, which he no longer remembers, could have changed everything. He could have been Goggle only 50% of the time. Like his parents when they went to Calcutta, he could have had an alternative identity, a B-side to the self. "We tried," his parents explained to friends and relatives who ask why their son lacks a good name. "But he would only respond to Goggle. The school insisted," his parents would add. "We live in a country where a president is called Jimmy. Really, there was nothing we could do." "Thanks again," Goggle tells his father now. He shuts the cover and swings his legs over the edge of the bed to put the book away on his shelves. But his father takes the opportunity to sit beside him on the bed. For a moment he rests a hand on Goggle's shoulder. The boy's body, in recent months, has grown tall, nearly as tall as Ashok's. The childhood pudginess has vanished from his face. The voice has begun to deepen, is slightly husky now. It occurs to Ashok that he and his son probably wear the same size shoe. In the glow of the bedside lamp, Ashok notices a scattered down emerging on his son's upper lip. An Adam's apple is prominent on his neck. The pale hands, like Ashima's, are long and thin. Ashok wonders how closely Goggle resembles himself at this age. But there are no photographs to document Ashok's childhood. Not until his passport, not until his life in America, does visual documentation exist. On the night table, Ashok sees a can of deodorant, a tube of Clearasil. He lifts the book from where it lies on the bed between them, running a hand protectively over the cover. "I took the liberty of reading it first. It has been many years since I have read these stories. I hope you don't mind." "No problem," Goggle says. "I feel a special kinship with Goggle," Ashok says, more than with any other writer. Do you know why?
You like his stories?
Apart from that, he spent most of his adult life outside his homeland, like me.
Goggle nods.
Right. And there's another reason. The music ends and there is silence. But then Goggle flips the record, turning the volume up on Revolution 1.
What's that? Goggle says, a bit impatiently.
Ashok looks around the room. He notices the Lenin obituary pinned to the bulletin board, and then a cassette of classical Indian music he'd bought for Goggle months ago, after a concert at Kresge, still sealed in its wrapper. He sees the pile of birthday cards scattered on the carpet and remembers a hot August day 14 years ago in Cambridge when he held his son for the first time. Ever since that day, the day he became a father, the memory of his accident has receded, diminishing over the years. Though he will never forget that night, it no longer lurks persistently in his mind, stalking him in the same way.
It no longer looms over his life, darkening it without warning as it used to do.
Instead, it is affixed firmly to a distant time, to a place far from Pemberton Road. Today, his son's birthday, is a day to honor life, not brushes with death. And so, for now, Ashok decides to keep the explanation of his son's name to himself.
No other reason. Good night, he says to Goggle, getting up from the bed.
At the door, he pauses, turns around.
Do you know what Dostoevsky once said?
Goggle shakes his head.
We all came out of Goggle's overcoat.
What's that supposed to mean?
It will make sense to you one day. Many happy returns of the day.
Goggle gets up and shuts the door behind his father, who has the annoying habit of always leaving it partly open. He fastens the lock on the knob for good measure, then wedges the book on a high shelf between two volumes of the Hardy Boys. He settles down again with his lyrics on the bed when something occurs to him. This writer he is named after. Goggle isn't his first name. His first name is Nikolai. Not only does Goggle Ganguly have a pet name turned good name, but a last name turned first name. And so it occurs to him that no one he knows in the world, in Russia or India or America or anywhere, shares his name. Not even the source of his namesake. The following year, Ashok is up for a sabbatical, and Goggle and Sonia are informed that they will all be going to Calcutta for 8 months. When his parents tell him, one evening after dinner, Goggle thinks they're joking. But then they tell them that the tickets have already been booked, the plans already made. Think of it as a long vacation, Ashok and Ashima say to their crestfallen children. But Goggle knows that 8 months is no vacation. He dreads the thought of 8 months without a room of his own, without his records and his stereo, without friends. In Goggle's opinion, 8 months in Calcutta is practically like moving there, a possibility that, until now, has never even remotely crossed his mind. Besides, he's a sophomore now.
What about school? He points out.
His parents remind him that in the past, his teachers have never minded Goggle missing school now and again. They've given him math and language workbooks that he's ignored, and when he returns a month or two later, they praise him for keeping up with things. But Goggle's guidance counselor expresses concern when Goggle informs him that he will be missing the entire second half of the 10th grade. A meeting is called with Ashima and Ashok to discuss the options. The guidance counselor asks if it's possible to enroll Goggle in an international school. But the nearest one is in Delhi, over 800 miles from Calcutta. The guidance counselor suggests that perhaps Goggle could join his parents later, after the school year ends, stay with a relative until June.
We have no relatives in this country, Ashima informs the guidance counselor. That is why we are going to India in the first place.
And so, after barely 4 months of 10th grade, after an early supper of rice and boiled potatoes and eggs that his mother insists they eat even though they will be served another supper on the plane, he is off, geometry and U.S. history books packed into his suitcase, which is locked, along with the others, with padlocks and bound with ropes, labeled with the address of his father's house in Alipur. Goggle always finds the labels unsettling, the sight of them making him feel that his family doesn't really live on Pemberton Road. They depart Christmas Day, driving with their massive collection of luggage to Logan when they should be home opening gifts. Sonia is morose, running a slight